This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 15th, 2004. I'm Nell Abram. Interim Afghan President Hamid Karzai delivers a speech to a joint meeting of Congress today. Ralph Nader is accused of a conflict of interest between his campaign and Citizen Watch. And today we look at resistance to controversial Diebold voting machines in the company's home state. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In an interview with the BBC, Brigadier General Janice Karpinski said the military officer now managing the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq told her that all prisoners should be treated like dogs. Major General Jeffrey Miller, who managed the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay, met with Karpinski prior to his transfer.
He said they are like dogs, and if you allow them to believe at any point that they're more than a dog, then you've lost control of them. And he said he was going to look at the locations and he was going to gitmoize the operation to make the operation for our detention operations more like they were in Guantanamo Bay.
A military spokesman said Miller never made the statements. Yet the Army is investigating the deaths of 127 prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan. Evidence compiled by military and congressional investigators indicates that top civilian and military leaders issued contradictory orders regarding how far to push the limits of the law on torture and whether all people being held by the U.S. government were to be protected by international law. Now the scandal moves to coalition partner England. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Four British soldiers are to face a court-martial charged with abusing Iraqi prisoners. It's the first of what could be a series of prosecutions over the conduct of British troops in Iraq. Charges against the four include indecent assault, the soldiers allegedly forcing victims to engage in sexual activity among themselves. They're also accused of military offences, prejudicing good order and military discipline. Military police are investigating fresh allegations of ill-treatment by British troops after complaints by the Red Cross. The Ministry of Defence told MPs last week that military police are investigating 75 cases, more than twice the number than ministers had previously admitted. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The group Citizen Watch says the September 11th Commission is not asking the right questions. Nicholas Ferreros has more from D.C.
The 9/11 Citizens Watch, a public group working to monitor and engage the government commission on the September 11th terrorist attacks, believes that many questions are being left unanswered by the official investigations and are demanding a greater transparency, accountability, and a more thorough inquiry. Speaking today at a Citizens Watch press conference in Washington, a survivor of the Pentagon attacks, April Gallup, discussed the frustration she has had with the investigations. Gallup, a former Pentagon researcher, and her young son were both at the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11 and have attended all of the commission's hearings since. She's extremely disappointed that such an important event has had so few answers and that the government seems hostile to a more thorough investigation.
You think with such a major catastrophic event, we'd be a little bit further or a little bit closer to the truth, and we're still not. And what's even worse is the more we ask the hard questions, the more we're attacked.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Nicholas Ferreros.
The Israeli military has reinstituted a checkpoint along the Gaza Strip, essentially cutting the small piece of occupied territory in half. Leila El-Haddad reports from Rafah.
Israeli occupation troops closed off the Abu Holi checkpoint in the central Gaza Strip earlier today, effectively dividing Gaza into two parts. Hundreds of travelers were stranded overnight at the crossing, unable to return to Gaza or continue onward to other destinations. Thousands of Palestinians commute daily between the southern and northern Gaza Strip, where they attend university or are employed, passing through the Abu Holi checkpoint on their way. 40 Palestinians who attempted to cross the checkpoint by foot with their hands raised in a gesture of peace were shot at by Israeli troops. Several tear gas canisters were also launched at the crowd, injuring a number of bystanders, including a 2-year-old infant and a 65-year-old man. The closure comes amidst a proposed plan by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to unilaterally disengage from the Gaza Strip, Critics of the plan say it is simply a means for Israel to hold on to large chunks of territory in the West Bank, where its troops will be redeployed. The seizure of large swaths of land has already started around at least three illegal Jewish settlements there, Gush Etzion, Ma'el Adumim, and Ariel, where Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mufaz says thousands of more homes will be built in the coming months. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leila El-Haddad in the Gaza Strip.
Texas Republican Tom DeLay is facing a rare inquest initiated by a member of his own party on charges of ethics violations. Renee Feltz reports from KPFT in Houston.
Bell's complaint to the House Ethics Committee is described by his staff as well-documented and focuses on three main allegations against DeLay. First, he cites 2002 memos from Westar Energy, which imply the company could win legislative benefits by donating to political committees associated with DeLay. Second, Bell describes how DeLay's Texans for a Republican Majority Political Action Committee violated state law by funneling almost $200,000 in corporate donations back to Texas GOP candidates. Finally, he alleges DeLay asked a federal agency to track a plane used by Democrats when they left the state during a GOP-led redistricting effort. The Ethics Committee could launch an investigation if it decides to accept the complaint. I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Hamid Karzai, the interim president of the Afghan Transitional Administration, began a two-day high-profile visit to Washington, D.C. today, meeting with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Colin Powell. Selena Masuda reports from Washington, D.C. that tomorrow Karzai will meet with President Bush.
At a joint session in Congress Tuesday, Afghan President Hamid Karzai was showered with applause for his update on the state of Afghanistan. Karzai stated a list of achievements to House and Senate members, but highlighted one in particular.
We have initiated the fight against narcotics. To save our children, to save your children and children across the world from the evil of addiction to drugs.
Karzai praised the U.S. for its involvement of toppling the Taliban government and aiding Afghanistan reconstruction efforts, but admitted that Afghanistan's security and economy remain weak. Issues such as lack of clean drinking water for a majority of Afghans, as well as the growing narcotics problem that has funded warlords and local militias, remain threats to stability. The ousting of the Taliban saw a rise in poppy production, a flowering plant that makes the illegal drug opium and heroin. The United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime released a report estimating that opium production in Afghanistan is at 3,400 metric tons, reestablishing the country as a leading producer of opium. Critics of the cracking down on the opium drug trade, like Doug McVeigh, a researcher for Common Sense for Drug Policy, say that prohibiting the cultivation of poppy will not deal with the issues of poverty in Afghanistan, especially when there are few alternatives.
When you have people who basically have nothing, you have to have money from somewhere. In some places, things like raw materials from the earth, whether it's oil or diamonds, are used. And in places where you can grow crops, then you have farmers who can produce crops that are of value to those countries like this one, which don't produce them. So things like coca and opium, heroin, become tradable commodities. In fact, the prohibition on them makes them even more valuable.
Despite the increase of insurgencies and deaths of U.S. military service people and Afghan fighters and civilians, Karzai praised the Afghan interim government for developing security forces. Still, the Afghani president acknowledges that security must be strengthened because Karzai is looking toward Afghanistan's public elections in September 2004 and is asking for further assistance from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO. NATO's top military commander in Afghanistan, General Rick Hillier, has stated that NATO does not have the capacity to put more troops on Afghani soil. Hillier has also stated that Afghanistan's inability to fight government corruption, as well as its drug trade, presents major obstacles to peace and security. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Selena Masuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader is coming under fire from campaign watchdog groups and finance experts for the appearance of a conflict of interest between his campaign and a public charity he created. Sunday's Washington Post reported that Nader's campaign has been using the same downtown Washington, D.C. offices that until recently housed the charity CitizenWorks. The campaign moved into the offices in October. Ben Adler reports.
The office in question is at a prime location in downtown Washington. The Washington Post reports that the same receptionist greets visitors for the campaign, the charity, and other subtenants, though the Nader campaign disputes that account. Teresa Amato is Nader's campaign manager. The Nader campaign told the Post she resigned from CitizenWorks in 2003, but the Post reports that in a January corporate filing with the District of Columbia, the charity listed Amato as its president and registered agent. Tax law explicitly forbids public charities from aiding political campaigns because donations to nonprofit organizations are tax deductible. Campaign law says candidates must account for all contributions, including shared office space and resources such as copy machines and telephones. Greg Colvin is a San Francisco tax attorney who specializes in laws governing nonprofit organizations. He says the arrangement between the Nader campaign and CitizenWorks could be legal, but only if all the rules are followed very carefully.
It depends on what the office space is like, whether it's easy to segregate into campaign areas and charitable activity areas or not, and whether they can come to a fair price for the campaign to pay the charity for the space it uses, so that there's no use of tax-deductible charitable money supporting the campaign.
I think we have here basically a sweetheart deal.
That's Frances Hill, a professor at the University of Miami School of Law and an expert on tax and campaign finance law. She's also the co-author of the book Taxation of Exempt Organizations. Hill says the fact that Nader's campaign even got the highly coveted office space calls the relationship between the campaign and the charity into question.
I can't imagine how a campaign would have had access to that space. Any campaign. There are lots of candidates for president apart from the Democrats and the Republicans, but this space was never publicly available, and somehow the charity's offices ended up being rented by the campaign.
Hill says that even if all the rules were followed, it does not mean the Nader campaign and CitizenWorks are off the hook.
When you have this non-publicly available space that suddenly ends up in the hands of a campaign that is headed by the same person that heads the charities, that represents an impermissible transfer of value from the charity to the campaign, and that's the problem for the charity.
Greg Colvin says an arrangement like this, whether legal or not, is probably a bad idea for the nonprofit organization.
Usually, charity's best advice to play it safe. You don't want to get into a dispute with the IRS over your tax-exempt status, and you certainly don't want to lose the goodwill of the public that could come from having those kind of questions asked.
If the Internal Revenue Service audits CitizenWorks and finds that either the charity is subsidizing the campaign or vice versa, the IRS can impose a 10% excise tax as a penalty. That would be separate from any penalties the Federal Election Commission might impose on the Nader campaign. The campaign declined comment for this story, but a spokesman said Nader's comments in the Post story speak for themselves. In the Post article, Nader says there was no wrongdoing, saying, quote, "You can search till kingdom come, you'll find no cross-subsidies here." Nader says an outside lawyer vetted the shared space arrangement and declared it to be legal, and CitizenWorks told the Post in an email it has provided no assistance to Nader's presidential campaign. But even the appearance of a conflict of interest could affect Nader's standing among his supporters. Larry Noble is executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics and a former general counsel for the FEC. He says the ethical questions in this case are amplified because of the nature of the candidate himself.
One of the problems here is that Ralph Nader has set himself up as someone who is very critical of how others run their campaigns and who has called for people to really run their campaigns in an atmosphere of good government and above board. And when doing this type of activity, it calls into question what exactly is going on and frankly puts a cloud over the campaign.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ben Adler.
The League of Women Voters rescinded its support of paperless voting machines yesterday after hundreds of angry members voiced concern that paper ballots were the only way to safeguard elections from fraud, hackers, or computer malfunctions. Last year, in a move that threatened to split the nonpartisan political education group, leaders had endorsed paperless terminals as reliable alternatives to punch cards and lever systems. Also yesterday, California approved touchscreen voting machines for Santa Clara County after officials agreed to stock paper ballots and the manufacturer of the machines Sequoia Voting Systems, agreed to hand over the source code for review. Last month, California decertified electronic voting machines statewide until counties take specific security measures. Santa Clara is only the third county to do so. Resistance to the controversial Diebold voting machines is intensifying in the company's home state of Ohio, as Ohio's Secretary of State has ordered at least one county to lease Diebold units for the November elections over the objections of that county's Board of Elections. Evan Davis has more from Ohio.
Ohio's Secretary of State Ken Blackwell has forced Lucas County near Toledo to lease optical scanning voting machines from the Diebold Corporation for the November election after the county's Board of Elections could not reach an agreement to purchase new electronic units to replace their antiquated punch card system. The board had been deadlocked for months, with its Republican members favoring the same Diebold touchscreen machines that were recently decertified in California, while the Democratic commissioners remained steadfastly opposed. Had the Lucas County Election Board agreed to purchase the Diebold touchscreen machines, state and federal funds would have covered the estimated $4 million cost. Now the county will have no other option than to lease optical scan devices, also produced by Diebold, at a cost of nearly $500,000, money that, according to at least one county commissioner, will be difficult for the county to raise. At the heart of the controversy are both the dubious performance record of Diebold voting machines already in use elsewhere in the country and the fact that touchscreen machines rely on proprietary software and produce no paper printouts which could be used to verify the votes cast. Marsha Robinson of Westerville, Ohio, heads the Citizens Alliance for Secure Voting, a local organization that is opposed to the Diebold machines as they are currently configured.
I don't understand Mr. Blackwell's motives. All I can tell you is that the Ohio Constitution requires the ability to conduct recounts. I can tell you that the Joint Committee has come up with a standard that exceeds federal standards on the ability to objectively recount with bubble sheets or scantrons. You'll be able to recount it manually by humans and also by machines. There will be no more questions of hanging chads if we implement this system by November, and it can be done if the assembly moves fast enough.
Diebold CEO Wally Odell, who pledged earlier this year to deliver Ohio to George Bush in the upcoming election, met with protesters at a recent shareholders meeting in Canton, Ohio, and offered his explanation as to why his company's machines were designed without printers.
But it is a very, very complicated issue. As soon as you go to a paper trail, then you have a lot of additional questions. Whether, what language is the paper trail in? Is it the official ballot or is the electronic the official? We're patient. We'll do it any way Ohio, California, or any other state wants to do it. But it is absolutely impossible to have certified paper trail equipment for November. There's nobody trying to buy it. There's no particular spec regarding it. The only possibility, if we insist on paper trails, is delay.
Bev Harris of BlackBoxVoting.org, a group that has been demanding paper auditable voting machines, also addressed the protesters in Canton.
We have been fighting against voting systems that are insecure because we feel it's a matter of time before, if we use these things, our vote won't count for much. So we have to roll up our sleeves and not give up until we have a paper ballot and proper auditing.
Susan Truitt, also with the Citizens Alliance for Secure Voting, spoke at a recent rally in Columbus, Ohio, just prior to similar rallies in Cleveland and elsewhere around the state.
We can't ignore the fact that these machines prohibit effective oversight, audits, or recounts, because everything takes place inside these machines and is therefore unobservable. Laws such as the Voting Rights Act cannot be enforced if there's nothing for the federal observers to observe and nothing for local poll watchers to watch. We cannot afford, nor can we permit, another major assault on the integrity of our American electoral process through the use of these machines without a paper trail.
In April of this year, Ohio's Governor Bob Taft signed a law requiring all Ohio counties to deploy voting machines with paper printouts by the year 2006. And despite the availability of federal funds to purchase paperless touchscreen machines this year, a majority of Ohio counties are opting instead to use their existing systems for the November election. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Ohio.
Last month's elections in India removed from power the BJP, led by Atal Bihari Vajpayee. The Congress, led by Sonia Gandhi, emerged the winner, but Gandhi refused the post of prime minister amid outrage that she was not born in India. The Congress ultimately elected Manmohan Singh, the architect of India's economic reforms and a respected consensus builder. As part of the parliamentary elections, polls were also held in the troubled state of Jammu and in Kashmir, or the Indian-administered Kashmir, where violence dominated the elections. Elections in Kashmir assume significance as the separatist groups asking for independence from India boycott the polls. India claims the participation of Kashmiri people in elections as evidence of their faith in Indian democracy. But violence and allegations of coercion and fraudulent voting are the norm. Shahnawaz Khan files this report.
The Congress alliance led by Manmohan Singh replaced the BJP government in India. And one of the questions most people had, what happens to the peace talks with Pakistan and with the Kashmiri separatist group All Parties Hurriyat Conference? The previous government led by Atal Bihari Vajpayee had initiated a peace process, and for the first time a Kashmiri group held talks with Indian Deputy Prime Minister Lal Krishan Advani. Before the two could meet for the third round in June, the government at the centre changed. The Kashmiri group, however, says they hope the change in government will not affect the process. Mirwais Umar is a member of the All Parties Hurriyat Conference.
Well, honestly, I don't think that, you know, that the change in the government in the center is going to affect their policy and approach towards Kashmir. Because even during the tenure of Mr. Vajpayee, the Congress played a very positive role vis-a-vis Pakistan and vis-a-vis Kashmir. And I believe that, you know, Congress has a responsibility, has a moral obligation to fulfill vis-a-vis Kashmir, because it was their leader, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, who came to Kashmir and promised the people of Kashmir that they would be given the right to determine their future.
At a gathering in Kashmir in 1947, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, had promised that the people of Kashmir would be given a right to determine their future. Analysts like Shajad Bukhari agree and say that Congress should stay the course despite its history.
Congress, I mean, it has a dubious distinction of destabilizing the political setup in Jammu and Kashmir in the last 50, 60 years, and especially when 1987 elections were held here and Congress was being held responsible for the large-scale rigging, which in fact made a turnaround in the history of Kashmir and the militancy started here. So I would say that Congress, if they would have learned any lessons from the history, they would not sabotage this process.
The Congress government has given signals that it would take the peace process forward, both with Pakistan and Kashmiri separatists. Bukhari, however, says fresh groundwork would have to be done, but adds that the new government may invite all the groups that were left out by the previous government. This, he says, would add credibility to the process. The BJP government had invited the moderates in the separatist camp and left out the hardliners. A demand for involving all the groups, including the militants, has been repeated time and again.
Unless and until they talk not only with the political leadership who are on the other side of the fence, but also to those people who are holding the guns, I mean the militants, unless they talk to the militants, because militant is the force which is on the ground, and whatever they want, I mean, they have the capacity to derail any peace process on the ground. So I think that Government of India should talk to all the groups, including militants, and it has to be an inclusive dialogue.
Involving all the separatist groups in the dialogue is also a challenge for Hurriyat Conference. A split last year has weakened its support base, and so far all efforts of unification have failed. Hardliners like Saeed Ali Gilani prefer to stay away from the process.
As far as their dialogue process is concerned, it has been proved that it is a futile exercise. Nothing will come out by this dialogue.
Engaging most of the separatist groups, including the militants, in dialogue will be a challenge both for the All Parties Hurriyat Conference and the new Indian government. Whether they succeed in it will determine how credible the peace process is going to be. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
In New York City, Mayor Michael Bloomberg took over the public school system in an attempt to show that he could improve public education in the city. Last Friday, nearly 12,000 third graders received holdback notices, meaning they failed the new One Test Determines Promotion standardized tests. Yesterday, the New York City Council said Harlem has the worst performing eighth graders in the city. The Radio Roots 8th graders from Harlem, New York, tell us about their recent experiences with the examinations. Anna Gelman reports.
It's almost the end of the school year, and summer vacation is coming. You might think that all the kids out there are happy and excited to be going on vacation, but there are some kids out there who are not. Some kids are stressed and depressed about testing.
Okay, what I need you to do is listen very carefully. On your desk right now, you should have your bubble sheet, right? You should have one ruler, a protractor, and you should have one or two pencils.
That was an eighth grade class at Crossroads taking a standardized test. Catherine Badia interviewed an eighth grader, Shayna, to talk about the test that she just took.
Well, we had the science test, the math test, and the humanities test. And I had to remember from fifth grade in Miss Mathis' class when we took when we studied a lot about humanities.
What were your feelings during the test?
Nervous. I was very nervous.
Most students feel nervous because they know that those tests will affect them later in their future. Educators like my principal, Ms. Wiener, also know how tests put kids under pressure. Pressure can also affect how well a child does on a test.
I think the fact that tests are timed doesn't allow some kids to show what they really know. For instance, if you're a second language learner and you're translating from English to Spanish back to English, that takes more time. Or if you're someone who has memory retrieval problems, if it takes a while to remember what a multiplication fact is, those students are not able to show what they know when they have to do 55 math problems in 60 minutes.
55 math problems in 60 minutes mean we get about 1 minute for each question. Sometimes it takes me 1 minute just to read the question. Ashley is a seventh grader. She was interviewed by Radio Roots reporter Anthony Bentances.
Do you think tests is a good way to see how a student is doing in school? Why? Or why not?
I don't think it's a good way because some children are like afraid of tests. Like, you know, they get scared and they do all the wrong answers even though they could know the correct answers.
What do you mean by scared?
Like, some people get paranoid when they see a test because they're worried if they're going to do bad.
Teaching to a test, to a specific test, is a problem because that doesn't give kids a real chance to learn really a variety of interesting materials that can engage them.
So the question is, if tests is so bad, why do we have them? We asked our principal, Ms. Wiener, if she had an answer to this question.
There always has to be accountability, and tests are one way for teachers in schools and kids to be held accountable.
I think that teachers should figure out if kids have learned anything or not, but there are other solutions to this problem. Anthony interviewed Ashley.
Is there another way that is not a test for a student to pass their grade?
Yeah, classwork or something on their behavior. On classwork, you could tell how they're doing because it's not really a test and they don't get anxious.
I think a performance test or a performance assessment would be another way.
Ms. Wiener has been an educator for a long time, and she has seen all the struggles that kids go through.
For instance, have students write a persuasive essay around a real situation.
As an eighth grader, I have a lot of experience on testing, and it affects me because it puts a big impact on what high school I will go to. On behalf of the Radio Roots team, I'm Anna Gelman. I'm a student at Crossroads.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Nell Abram.